You are listening to a Blazing Caribou Studios production.
Bonus. Something extra that is good. B-O-N-U-S. Bonus.
What's up, team? Welcome into another episode of Two Peas. So happy that you're here once again. We got another bonus episode for you. We have a cavalcade of guests come on every week, pretty much every week, when Andy cannot join us, which is super frequently. So I have an awesome guest on today. He's been on once before. He came on last month, and we talked about our favorite Tim Burton characters, of course, in conjunction with the release of the live-action Dumbo that just came out last month. But he's back. I'm excited to have him. I love his show. I'll let him talk a little bit about his show as well, for those of you that don't know. But please say what's up to Jeff from Cadavercast. Jeff, what's up, man?
Hey, thanks for having me back, man.
Absolutely, brother. Tell everyone real quick, you've only been on once before. You know, I have guests that are kind of regulars that come on almost every month, and this is only your second time. So tell people a little bit about Cadavercast, because I think it's an awesome show.
Yeah, it's a show hosted by my 7-year-old son. We've been going since it was 4. It was definitely me hosting more so early on, but let him take the reins and kind of do what he wants to do. And we talk about monster movies, and not just like monster movies that he can watch, but also monsters that are in movies he can't watch as yet. That's now a big part of the show, is me sitting down with him and going, okay, who do you think Leatherface is? You know, just seeing what he thinks. Which can get pretty wild.
Right, right. And he doesn't have any knowledge of those characters going into you probing him about it, right?
Sometimes. I mean, like, when we did an episode on Jason, he knew quite a bit about Jason. He had met, what's his name? Ari... Oh, I can't remember his last name. The guy who played Jason as a kid, right, in the first movie, and he comes up out of the water.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So Al had met him and, like, talked to him about Jason, and I have on my wall here a display of horror figures and stuff, so he knows what they look like generally, but apart from the basics, he's it's all guesswork.
Yeah, I mean, these kids, man, they soak it up too. You got to be careful. Like last night, I was hanging out with my son last night. He's 5, and he asked me what Truth or Dare was, and I'm like, how the hell do you know what Truth or Dare is? You're 5. What are you guys doing in preschool, you know? So you just never know what they pick up out there in the world, man. So yeah.
But soak it up and repeat every single word you ever say.
Absolutely, no question. So you got to be careful out there, parents. I'm living proof, believe me. Well, today, Jeff, I don't know if this is going to be a little bit out of your comfort zone. I'll let you talk about it a little bit, but just to let the people know, we are counting down our top 5 best picture winners, and that's specifically for the Academy Awards, for the Oscars. I want to say this year is the 91st Academy Awards. Is that right? Or do you know?
Sounds about right.
I think that's right. So really 90 films
It was 28. Yeah, that sounds right. It started in 28. Sounds right.
Yeah, so 90 films that would be eligible for our top 5 list today. What did you think, man, when you were looking back at some of these? Because I know you, with the monster movies in particular, you go old school. You're an old school guy, so... Without giving any of your picks away, I mean, is this a modern list? Is this a mixed bag? What do you got over there?
I mean, mine is maybe veering towards the older stuff, but I do a little bit of everything. You know, it's my public persona is now as like the horror guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, also, I mean, it's not something that I guess I help in my day to day life. Like, I'm always just wearing horror shirts and horror pins. And I'm wearing three pieces of horror clothing right now.
Right.
4, including my socks. So head to toe horror. But I mean, I've studied film, I mean, since I was a teenager. So we're looking at 20 years of like dedicated film studies now. I teach film, I teach screenwriting. So, you know, this is in my wheelhouse. It's just not, I think, the image I've set up for myself is that, you know, this maybe wouldn't be, but it totally is.
Right, right. And, you know, I'm a big horror fan as well, which you probably know from listening to the show, but I'm a horror junkie too, but I'm also just a cinephile. You know, I just love movies, always have. I'm going on 43 years old, and I've always loved movies. I mean, for as long back as I can remember, to the animated classics and Disney and that kind of thing up until today. So, you know, when I was looking at these and when I was making my list, most of them, with the exception of one, are in the last like 25 to 30 years. So they're pretty recent when you're talking 90 years worth of cinema. So what do you think? You think crossover, or what do you think?
Maybe. Yeah. we'll go a big maybe on that. Yeah. I don't know. It was tough. I mean, for me, it's like I'd seen about 50 of the 90 or so. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems I was running into is a lot of them I'd go, I know that's a great film, but I haven't seen it in, you know, 18 years or something like that. And how does it hold up personally? Don't know. You know, so like that was a problem I was running into as well.
Yeah, same here. And there's some that, I felt the same way. I'm like, wow, that was probably an awesome movie. And I remember it being awesome, but I just haven't seen it in 30 years.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to really recollect. But, you know, my top five are five of my favorites. I feel like the Academy doesn't always get it right. There are some movies, in my opinion, in many years that were nominated that would have been a nominee that were better than the winner. But of course, just so everyone knows, we're only picking movies that actually walked away with the Best Picture Oscar. So,
yeah, my list would have been way different if Citizen Kane had won over How Green Was My Valley and Taxi Driver had won over Rocky. Mm-hmm. My list would be totally different.
Yeah,
my top three anyway.
Absolutely, man. All right, so let's do it, man. You ready? You excited?
Yeah,
so you got your list there. You want to kick us off with your number five, Jeff?
Yeah, sure. I also want to point out this list has been so insane to make because I have changed it constantly to the point where the things I'm gonna say here in the show aren't even what's written on my list.
I was gonna say you don't know what you're about to say.
I pulled up the list earlier this morning. I was like, I don't know how I feel about this, and I was like, we'll feel it out as we get there. Yeah. But my number five is a film that was in and out of my top five mostly because of, I don't know, the infrequency with which I watch it, but. I mean, it's undeniably a classic and super important and great. And it's The Godfather from 1972. There we go.
You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man. You look terrible. I want you to eat. I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse. Now just go outside, enjoy yourself, and forget about all this nonsense. I want you to leave all to me.
All right.
So the original, yeah?
Yeah.
Didn't Godfather 2 win as well?
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if that one's going to come up later, so you don't have to spoil it, but I prefer the sequel over the original, and the original is one of those that I really haven't seen more than maybe twice, and it's also been a long time since I've seen it.
I have a weird hang-up with the sequel, but it's an aesthetic thing.
Okay.
So it has nothing to do with the quality of the movie itself. There's certain movies that are set in certain locales that I just kind of don't like the aesthetics of it. And so I'd much rather watch something like The Godfather. It's a weird hang up. I don't know. It's maybe some compulsion I should have looked at, but no, I mean, the Godfather is, you know, somebody was talking about it the other day and I haven't seen it in a few years. And they were like, you know, oh, what's the name of this character? And I was like, oh, that's this person. This person did that. You know, and I like started talking about the movie as though I had watched it a week ago. You know, it's so fresh in my mind. And I think that's why my list is changed here in the moment, because it really has stood the test of time, not just with, you know, film lovers, cinephiles, but also, I mean, just in my mind, it's stuck there. It's resonated. And it's also responsible for, I don't know, just the way that films are distributed. It changed the way that Hollywood films are distributed. It, you know, laid the groundwork for the, you know, the gangster movies, the mafia movies that we've seen over the decades. You know, its importance, I think, can't be understated.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I agree with everything you said. And obviously, I realize the impact and the importance of it. This is a personal list for me. And, you know, I got into movies deep into movies, like going to the theater and buying movies on VHS and DVD in the 90s. So all of my list is post 1990, really. And the God. So for me, it was more like Goodfellas, Casino, like that kind of stuff.
Sure,
in this,
sure.
In this genre. Personally, but when somebody says The Godfather is one of the greatest movies of all time, I mean, I definitely won't argue with that, and I can see why it is considered such, because you wouldn't have Goodfellas without movies like The Godfather, or Sopranos, which was one of my favorite TV shows.
And it may have something to do with the fact that I was also teaching with Goodfellas yesterday, that I think this kind of got pushed up in my mind. I was like, man, I wouldn't have had that amazing discussion with my students about how great the dialogue is in Goodfellas were it not for The Godfather existing.
I got you. Awesome, man. All right. Well, that's a good way to get us started. I mean, definitely a classic. So The Godfather is your number five. I am going to go much more modern. Like I said, everything in my list is post-90s up to today. So this film came out in 2008, directed by female Catherine Bigelow. It is The Hurt Locker is my number five. You've seen this one, Jeff?
Yeah. Saw that.
I love this movie. Obviously a war film, a war epic. It's an action film, too. It's got a brooding tension throughout the whole movie. I love movies that are like exciting to watch that you have to like, you know, your kind of heart's beating, your heart rate's elevated during the course of the movie. And for the better part of 50 to 60% of this movie, your heart rate is like that. You know, Catherine Bigelow does an awesome job of putting the viewer in the shoes of these guys in Iraq. Jeremy Renner, an amazing performance, possibly his best to date in his career, even with everything he's done since then.
I wouldn't argue that.
Yeah,
he's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Anthony Mackie's awesome. I've always liked him. Guy Pearce has a smaller role in this, but I've always liked him. A lot of awards for this movie, too, back in at the 2009 Academy Awards. I mean, aside from film, original screenplay, it was nominated for, I think, four or five others. Just a great movie, man. She went on to do Zero Dark Thirty, which is also kind of a war story surrounding kind of the bin Laden capture. But yeah, I mean, I love Catherine Bigelow's films, even all the way back to Point Break in the 90s with Keanu Reeves. I love her.
Point Break.
Yeah.
Near Dark. Hers. Oh, Near man, Dark. That's a good
yeah.
one.
Yeah, I love her as a director, which probably biases me a little bit in this pick, but I can remember seeing The Hurt Locker in cinemas and just being just nervous and just excited and kind of, you know, it's one of those movies where you grip your armrest and your heart rate goes up and you know, it's just exciting to watch, especially on a first time viewing. I think this movie is best watched with virgin eyes, not having seen it before. I've went back to revisit it a couple times and I still enjoy it. I own it. But I remember it was just so exciting the first time I saw it. And I thought it was awesome that the Academy recognized a film like that. You know, not all Academy Award winners have to be timid and kind of, you know, dull. Not to say that any of our picks might fall in that category. But, you know, it's just cool that they pick such kind of a high adrenaline film as their best picture that year. So The Hurt Locker is my number five.
Yeah, it's also a really challenging movie too. You know, for a war movie, it's got none of that, you know, gung-ho, yay America nationalism to it. You know, it doesn't paint war in a good light at all.
Right, right.
And so I appreciated that.
Good, man. So no crossover yet, huh?
No.
Not yet.
No crossover yet.
Too early, perhaps.
Maybe.
All right, man. What's your number four, Jeff?
All right, my number four is, okay, sorry, I'm reordering it in my head as we go.
So, of course you are.
more like I'm pulling out one so that I could put Godfather in. My number four, then, is 1991's The Silence of the Lambs.
Hello, Clarice.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
Closer, please. Closer.
There we go.
So, I mean, it's a horror movie that won the Best Picture Award. And, you know, as a horror fan, it's a movie that for a long time I was bitter about because, you know, when I would point out, well, no, a horror movie won Best Picture, people go, no, 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 that's a psychological thriller.
Yeah,
that argument
still flies around, yeah.
It's a thriller, yeah, but I mean, any horror film is also like a family drama or like, you know, a drama about parenting that also happens to be a horror film. And yeah, this is multiple things, but that's what makes it great. It's got all these layers to it. And the more I revisit it, the more I look at it, the more amazed I am that the movie is a horror film, one that won Best Picture, but also that, you know, that it got the recognition it deserved. You know, a film about cannibals, about skinning people and everything.
Yeah,
gets overlooked, but this didn't, you know? And it's so well made, just expertly crafted.
Mm-hmm.
Iconic performances too, obviously.
I agree, man. I didn't mean to cut you off there. I agree. This is on my list too, so I'll go ahead and just kind of give a little dialogue on it. It's my number three, so it's coming up here shortly. I mean, much for the same reason that you mentioned, I mean, really because horror got recognition, which never happens with the Academy. I don't know why. This year is a prime example. Toni Collette and Hereditary. You're never going to convince me that that's not one of the best actress performances of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, just unbelievable performance that really carried the film and just, I mean, it was unsettling. And anyway, I know we're not talking about 2018 movies, but my point is the Academy doesn't tend to, they have a little bit of a bias against horror movies for whatever the case may be. Now, I want to tell you real quick, and I want to come clean. I don't know if you heard when we did, it's been several months ago, but we did our 90s horror movie top five. And I purposely
probably listened to it.
I purposely didn't put Silence of the Lambs on that top five. I did mention it later in my honorable mentions. And the same thing was said for movies like The Sixth Sense and Seven as well. So, you know, those kind of all fall in the same umbrella where there's elements of horror in them. But if you had to pigeonhole them to a category, I don't know that it would be horror. At least, and when I say I don't know, I mean like the majority may not put it in horror. I don't know. It's a weird argument because like it's a horror movie. You know what I mean? But it's just one of those things. Like, you know, my number one on that list that we did was Scream, you know, and I think Scream is undeniably a horror movie. Like there's very few categories that it could go into other than horror, if any. Whereas Silence of the Lambs is definitely multi-genre. With that being said, Anthony Hopkins, I think I read that he was only on screen for like 12 minutes in this movie.
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah, but just, I mean, iconic. I mean, it'll go down forever as one of the greatest cinematic characters and cinematic villains, Hannibal Lecter. Jodie Foster is awesome in this. I want to say both of them won, too, that year. I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, but it swept the top five, awards, right? It was one of three movies ever to do that.
Yeah, Jonathan Demme, I believe, was the director, and he won that year, or at least was nominated. Yeah, man. I mean, same reason you said, I won't beat a dead horse, but I mean, Silence of the Lambs is awesome because it just gave notoriety to a genre that the Academy is infamously kind of has a bias against, and it's unfortunate. I mentioned Toni Collette. I mean, Emily Blunt in A Quiet Place last year, one of the best performances of the year, and I just don't get it. She even won the Screen Actors Guild Award, so even the actors in Hollywood voted her as the best actress last year, and the Academy still didn't give her a nomination. So it's just crazy to me that just bias kind of exists, and it really drives me nuts because I'm a horror junkie, much like yourself.
Yeah, and I write horror movies too, and so like that's a thing that I also get like from people is, oh, why do you write horror movies? What's the value in that? You know, and it hurts. You know, it cuts deep, man.
It's crazy, man, because, you know, horror movies can have depth to them. You know, they can have awesome character development, and they can definitely have amazing performances. And I don't know, someday, you know what, me and you, my daughter is funny, man. She's 17, right? I have a teenage daughter, and she wants to go into film editing. You've probably heard me talk about that before.
Mm-hmm.
But she's going to the School of the Arts here locally, and she's going into film editing. And we were talking about this year's Academy Award nominees, and my daughter's funny. We're texting back and forth, and she goes, yeah, you know, they never get it right. She goes, you know, it's bad when I'm literally going into film so I can grow up, be on the Academy and make some changes, you know. So she has a plan in place to try to get them back on the right course. So we'll see how that plays out. But I'm proud of her. She's just a trip, man. So that was your number four, Silence of the Lambs. It's going to be my number three. So let me give you my number four real quick. And then maybe we can have an open dialogue about this because I feel like this might have to be talked about. But my number four would actually be higher if it weren't for one thing. I couldn't not include it because I absolutely love this movie. I loved it when it came out. I remember when it came out, I remember thinking for a brief moment, like, wow, this might be the best fucking movie I've ever seen. Like, I remember thinking that for a couple minutes. It's still in my probably top 10 of all time, but I wouldn't say that anymore. But I remember it just hit me so hard when I first saw it. From 1999, it's American Beauty.
Yeah, yeah. I had a feeling this, we were going to hit this at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I love this movie. I mean, directed by Sam Mendes. Amazing performances in it. I mean, say what you will. Before I talk about you know who, Chris Cooper as a supporting actor in this movie. You know, the next door neighbor.
Brilliant.
Just absolutely haunting and amazing and visceral and very soft at the same time. I mean, it was just amazing journey that you went on with that character. Just heartbreaking, Chris Cooper in this movie. Obviously, Annette Bening. I feel like she either won or was nominated for this. And then what do you want to say about Kevin Spacey? Because, I mean, he is obviously kind of the... Yeah, I mean, he's the foundation of the film as Lester Burnham in this movie.
Your father and I were just discussing his day at work. Why don't you tell our daughter about it, honey?
Janie, today I quit my job. And then I told my boss to go fuck himself, and then I blackmailed him for almost $60,000. Pass the asparagus.
Your father seems to think this kind of behavior is something to be proud of.
And your mother seems to prefer that I go through life like a fucking prisoner while she keeps my dick in a mason jar under the sink.
How dare you speak to me that way in front of her? And I marvel that you can be so contemptuous of me on the same day that you lose your job.
I didn't lose it. It's not like, whoops, where'd my job go? I quit. Someone pass the asparagus.
Oh, and I want to thank you for putting me under the added pressure of being the sole breadwinner now.
I already have a job.
No, don't give a second thought as to who's going to pay the mortgage. We'll just leave it all up to Carolyn. You mean you're going to take care of everything now, Carolyn? Yes, I don't mind. I really don't. You mean everything? You don't mind having the sole responsibility? Your husband feels he can just quit his job and you don't...
Will someone who's please gonna pay the pass me now? The
okay,
fucking
guys,
asparagus.
I'm not going to be a part of this.
Shut up! I am sick and tired of being treated like I don't exist. You two do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it, and I don't complain. All I want
is
the same...
Oh, you don't complain? Oh, please, excuse me. I must be psychotic then. If you don't complain, what is this? Yeah, let's bring in the laugh meter and see how loud it gets on that one. You don't complain.
Don't interrupt me, honey. And another thing. From now on, we're going to alternate our dinner music because, frankly, and I don't think I'm alone here, I'm really tired of this Lawrence Welk shit.
Talk to me a little bit about it, Jeff. I mean, we don't have to go crazy on a Spacey rant today, but I mean, are you able to kind of separate the art, especially from like 1999, to what's going on today when it comes to Spacey?
It's hard, and it's especially hard because, like, I also taught for a number of years a class called Ethics in Computer Games and Cinema. Mm-hmm. And so, like, when this stuff happens, it becomes really hard for me to, you know, separate the moral choices of individuals behind a movie and the movies that they make and mm-hmm. to revisit that. And it really is hard. And it sucks because, you know, American Beauty was when it came out in 1999. And then I saw it probably in 1999. You know, it was for a while, I think, like my favorite movie. And mm-hmm. I was in high school when it came out. So it was like, that's one of the things that I was like, I want to make movies like this. I want to go out and make movies. And it was hugely important to me, and I can't deny that for sure. But it really is, I think it's more painful to think about the fact that I have so long talked about how great somebody is just to have them, you know, be revealed to be not a great human being. And I think that's kind of what hurts, at least for me. And I think that more so than not being able to separate the work from the artist, which I don't really have a problem with. It just hurts for me to have extolled the virtues of Kevin Spacey and his performances for so long, just to have that kind of, you know,
it's disappointing. Come back. I mean, it's disappointing. It's a bit of a letdown. And you try to, you know, separate the art, but it, I mean, it's just tough because that's always kind of floating, especially in today's day and age, because it's on social media and I mean, you know, every 5 minutes there's, you know, somebody's making an accusation or reading an old tweet or, I mean, whatever, you know. So frankly, it's a different time than it was in 99 when this movie came out. So,
well, and I don't know, man. Too. For me, it comes down to, you know, one, what the person did and has done, but two, also what they do after that. You know, and that's a big point for me. It's not so much like, do I forgive them for the thing, but are they doing something about what they're doing?
Right. You know,
and I don't think Kevin Spacey, especially when he released that video afterwards, he's not. He didn't feel bad about it. You know,
wow.
Whereas somebody like a James Gunn or whatever, he comes from a trauma background. He posted some gross tweets or whatever. He came from a shock humor background that he's clearly, you know, at some point in his life gone, no, like, this is actually inappropriate and I'm not that person anymore and I feel bad and I'm going to make the world a better place. He's somebody who's moved on from that.
Right.
But we don't get that from Kevin Spacey.
No, not to this point. Absolutely not. I mean, American Beauty as a film. So to take Spacey's name kind of out of the equation, I mean, of course, his performance, I mean, he won the best actor that year for that. And, you know, he might be a piece of shit off camera, but I mean, he was great at his craft, you know, and there's a lot of films and a lot of roles that he's had that have been just tremendous. And this might be his best. I mean, he won the Oscar for this. You know, the movie, what I don't like about today's day and age, and I'm not saying you're doing this or I might even be indirectly doing this, but when an entire project gets kind of shit on because of one person's idiocy. And I feel like you can't discredit American Beauty as a work of art because of what we found out X number of years later about Spacey.
Absolutely not.
And I also don't know, in fairness to Spacey, I also don't know that American Beauty would have been the same movie without his performance. You know, like if it had been another actor in that role. So, of course, we never will know that unless they decide to remake it, which they probably will because they remake everything. But I don't know. I love this movie, man. Like I said, you know, it's weird because this movie would probably be like my number two. But the name Spacey just kind of taints everything. And it really sucks.
It really sucks. Makes it hard to, especially as someone who teaches film, you know, and I'm trying to introduce students to cinema of years gone by.
Of course.
And, you know, if I go to show them something by Roman Polanski, then, like, I mean, the whole thing of him sleeping with a 15-year-old has to come up, you know, and that's, it's just, it's so difficult, you know, and like something like Chinatown, amazing. But it is hard for me to go out and push Chinatown on anybody, you know?
Yeah. And then you have, like, you know, Woody Allen films. There have been some classics, but it's Woody Allen. So, of course, you know, it's going to come up, Annie Hall or whatever. So, I don't know, man. It's tough. You know, it's kind of like, it's similar to, like, you know, the U.S. president. You know, and I'm not talking about the current one because I'm not a fan, but just in general, where, you know, they might be a great president, but maybe they were scandalous and they cheated on their wife or whatever. So they're a bad person, you know, or they have a bad trait in their personality, but they lead the country well. You know, it's kind of the same type deal. And it's in today's day and age with social media and just the media in general, I feel like it's almost impossible to separate the two.
Sure.
That's what kind of stinks a little bit.
What's great, though, and to the credit of your daughter, is that we have a whole generation of filmmakers, future filmmakers studying right now who really see all of that garbage out in the world and want to do better.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
So hopefully, man, this next generation of filmmakers coming in, you know, the ones that I'm teaching, your daughter, they're really... they're not going to put up with it and they're not going to turn a blind eye like so many people may have been forced to do or may have willingly done for so many years, you know?
Right.
And we'll just have a better film industry, something we can be more proud of.
Right. I agree. I think that's definitely a silver lining. Absolutely. So there we go. My number four was American Beauty. Not sure if I'll get heat for that, but I just love that movie, man. And, you know, like I said, it's not because of Spacey. I mean, he was in it, but Chris Cooper was my favorite performance in that movie. And the direction was amazing. It was just beautiful. And I remember I saw it and I just thought, man, this isn't a movie. This is like a piece of moving art. I mean, it was just something that I'd never seen before. So I had to put it on there. So that's my number four, which leads us over to your number three, man. What do you got?
All right. My number three. And I'll tell you originally, my number three, and this is why my list got shifted around this morning. My number three was going to be Annie Hall.
Okay.
Because of Woody Allen and then thinking about Goodfellas and stuff.
Perfect example. See? There
yeah. This is why it got shifted out and then Godfather got shifted in. Mm-hmm. But that makes my number three the most recent movie on my list, which, I mean, judging by the Facebook response to what you posted, this may be the most contentious because I don't think I saw it on anybody's list, which is 2007's No Country for Old Men.
It's on my honorable mentions. It's going to come up later when we talk about honorables. I feel like one person may have mentioned that online, but go ahead and talk about it. I mean, I love this movie, man.
I think it was a tough movie for some people because it's purposely anti-genre convention, you know? I mean, being directed by the Coens, adapted from the amazing novel by Cormac McCarthy, you know, it does so many things that filmmakers would generally be terrified to do. And I mean, just goes headlong into things, you know, and I don't want to spoil anything about the movie, but what you expect from an action movie, you know, a movie that's effectively a chase movie about, you know, theft and hitmen and drugs and stuff. It really does totally different things with this, all in service of, you know, these questions about, you know, what is this world we live in? And like, was the past better? Or, you know, was the past just as messed up, but in ways that I understand, you know? And I don't know, I saw it, two, three times in the theater. This is the one movie ever that was up for Best Picture that I was like, if this doesn't win, I'm never watching the Oscars again.
Right. Which actually they didn't disappoint us because usually you feel that way and then it doesn't win. So they got it right this year. I will say the Academy loves the Coens. They have a love affair with the Coens, which is okay because I love them too. At least it's not a duo or a filmmaker that I'm not crazy about. But, you know, like this year with Buster Scruggs getting nominated in a couple different categories. I mean, they just, anytime the Coens do something, the Academy nominates them. So I don't know if you've noticed that, but.
Well, I mean, they're brilliant. They do things don't do otherwise, you know.
I agree. They're awesome. But, you know, what's cool for me about No Country, it's on my honorables, but I'll just give a quick dialogue about it, is this is like a villain story to me. You know, this is like following a bad guy at kind of, and it does a great job. And there's other movies that have done this, of course, but it does a great job of the making the audience root for and against them. And I'm talking about Anton, of course. And you kind of just connect with that character. You don't want him to succeed, but at the same time, you kind of do. And it does have like a little bit of a chase vibe, like you said. But I mean, Javier Bardem in this movie is just
unbelievable.
Tremendous.
That
tremendous
performance.
Yeah. And I love Tommy Lee Jones too. He's an all-time in my opinion. But yeah, a great pick, man. I love it. No Country for Old Men. Good one. So we already talked about my number three, which was Silence of the Lambs. So we can skip right over that because we talked about the that it is and isn't a horror movie. I don't know what we're really saying there, but I'm glad that the Academy recognized it back in 1991. Anthony Hopkins, obviously phenomenal in that film. One of his most notable roles. But that was my number three.
Ted Levine, too. I mean, like, his name doesn't get brought up, but I mean, without Buffalo Bill.
That's true. You know, that's true. All right, man. A lot of memes and gifts too, thanks to Buffalo Bill.
So. Yeah.
All right, man. So we're up to our runner ups. What's your number two, buddy?
All right, my number two. This was tough. These top two, I did go back and forth a lot, but I knew these were my top two from the start. So it could have gone either way. But my number two is 1942's Casablanca.
Oh, here we go. Here, this is Jeff now. This is Jeff getting old school.
You have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up at a concentration camp. Isn't that true, Louis?
I'm afraid, Major Strauss, I would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
What about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. Now, now. He's looking at you, kid.
Man, it really is just one of the absolute greatest films ever made, and I can't watch the damn thing without crying. You know, it's one of those movies that if there's a handful of movies, maybe like 5 to 10 movies, that if somebody goes, the best movie ever made is this movie, that I'll go, yeah, no, absolutely, I buy that. And Casablanca is one of those. If somebody comes at me with Casablanca is the best movie ever made, I would go, yeah, no, you're right, sure. Like, I can't argue with that. I think it's perfect in almost every way. It's iconic, obviously. One of the great Hollywood films ever made. Humphrey Bogart is incredible, obviously. Ingrid Bergman's. I mean, everybody, Claude Rains, it's the dialogue we quote to this day. It gets referenced. I don't know. It's just such a, it's a landmark of cinema. And it is one of those times where undeniably the Academy got it right, because this is a movie that still, you know, came out in 1942 and is still a movie that you can watch. And I don't know about everybody, but me, at least, I can watch and it still moves me every time.
Yeah, I haven't seen this in forever, brother. In fact, I had to watch this, ironically, since you're a teacher, you'll appreciate this, but I had to watch this for a film class in college, and that was the last time I saw it. So I don't even remember what year that was, but that was at least 20 years ago. So I haven't seen this in forever. I don't know. How can I phrase this? I do respect it. I guess I don't enjoy it as much as like diehard fans, probably like yourself, of this film, like enjoy it when they watch it. I watch it with a level of respect, if that makes sense. And obviously the impact and everything that's happened since it came out. I mean, like you said, I mean, no question that it's one of the greatest films of all time. If somebody says that, you go, yep, of course. Yeah, you're right. No argument. You know, and I haven't seen it forever, but I just respect this movie. I guess is the best way for me to kind of categorize my attachment to it. I wouldn't like pull it out and be like, oh, I want to watch Casablanca because I love it. I would pull it out to, like, you know, show my daughter and be like, hey, you need to watch this as a landmark cinema event, you know, like that kind of thing, like a historical kind of viewing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And the fact that, again, I do teach film also does change the complexion of the way I look at it as well. And the fact that I'm also a screenwriter, you know, both of those things tie into it too, that I look at it. And it's not necessarily something that personally I'm like, yes, I connect with this story about, you know, hiding out in Africa during World War II or what, like that. It doesn't, like, on a personal level, but like it is inspiring to me to look at a movie that's so expertly crafted and think that like the art form at its best, you know, is something that can, you know, stand the test of time.
I agree.
And I find that inspirational to no end as an instructor, as a filmmaker. It's hugely important to me in that way. But like you said, it's not a movie that on a day-to-day basis, I don't break the movie out. I mean, I'm more likely to watch Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon on any day of the week than Casablanca.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah, but when you see it, I mean, there's no refuting it and what it did for cinema. And, you know, it's 1942, you said, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in the 40s, I mean, they didn't have even half of what we have today in terms of being able to capture an audience. And in 1942, you're going on performances. I mean, right? You're going on direction, cinematography. It's just
the craft at its most basic, like, tactile form. I mean, you're working with film stock. You're working, you know, with screenwriters who are on a studio staff, you know, by all rights. It should be movie by committee that would just, you know, by today, movies by committee are terrible, you know, but you look at something like Casablanca and the studio system was, it just gelled, you know, from like 39 to the mid 40s. It was just like, you know, it just all came together.
Right. I agree, man. Great pick. I was wondering how old school you were going to go. So I'm excited actually that you brought an old one to the list there. So Casablanca is your runner up. So my runner-up is a remake. It's a film that got remade. Now, look, we talked about Goodfellas earlier, which came out in 1990, did not win Best Picture. It was nominated for Scorsese, but it did not win. Goodfellas is my number one favorite movie of all time. And I recently made that top 10 list for our friends over in Australia, The Countdown. And it ended up being placed at my number one. This film won the Academy Award in 2006. It is not as good as Goodfellas, in my opinion. But it did win. And it's basically Goodfellas in Boston. Mm-hmm. It's also directed by Martin Scorsese. The Departed, from 2006, is my number two.
You accused me once. I put up with it. You accused me twice. I quit. You pressure me to fear for my life, and I will put a fucking bullet in your head as if you were anybody else, okay?
You got something you wanna ask me?
Look, you're 70 years old, Frank. I'm just saying, okay? One of you guys is gonna pop you. One of you guys is gonna pop you. As for running drugs, what the fuck are you doing? What are you doing? You don't need the money or the pain in the ass, and they will catch you.
I haven't needed the money since I took Archie's milk money in the third grade. Tell you the truth, I don't need pussy anymore either. But I like it.
Hell of a movie, that.
Yeah. It's like I said, it's very similar to the same genre we were talking about with Godfather and Goodfellas, just kind of modernized a little bit. I mean, the cast, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jack Nicholson, Wahlberg, who else in there? Matt Damon's in there, Martin Sheen, Alec Baldwin, right? Verma Farmiga, just on and on and on and on. And then, of course, Scorsese behind the lens. So, this film was just like, I was just like, holy shit. First of all, it's Scorsese. I'm a huge fan of his. I know that he's done some movies that weren't as well received as this one or Goodfellas, but I love all his movies and I kind of am drawn to his style of filmmaking. And I think he's kind of similar to like a Tarantino, where I just, no matter what it is visually, I love it. And The Departed was definitely that. Leonardo DiCaprio is what really, really touched me in this film, because he just, I know he won for The Revenant, and I feel like that was more of a political win because he had gotten passed over so many times.
Yeah, but he almost was freezing to death while making The Revenant or whatever. So
yeah,
they're like,
yeah,
give him the Oscar. He almost died.
Exactly. But this is his performance, man. If you watch DiCaprio in The Departed and kind of how he has to, be undercover, right, with Nicholson, but he's also dealing with the cops, or kind of like in Witness for them, just that internal struggle that he deals with, it's almost like he has a split personality, and he just slowly over time throughout the movie just kind of goes mad, and you can see like his appearance starts to change. It's almost like he doesn't know if he's good or if he's bad. He doesn't know if he wants to be a gangster or if he wants to help the cops. It's just a very back and forth that DiCaprio just absolutely nailed in this movie. And he has done some amazing work. And to date, this is still my favorite performance of his. I know that there's other ones out there that people will quote, and I would agree with those too. This is obviously a personal pick for me, but this is my favorite DiCaprio role. Jack Nicholson's an all-time man, and he really excels in this role too. Mark Wahlberg is kind of genius casting for this Boston cop, this kind of, because he's basically playing himself in the movie, and I thought that was really cool too. So I love The Departed. It was awesome for me when it happened. It was awesome because it was like, okay, this is a little bit of kind of payback for Goodfellas getting passed over 15 years earlier, because it's a very, very similar arc of a movie, and the Academy recognized it. So The Departed is my number two.
That's a solid pick, man. I'm a big fan of The Departed as well. But like you said, in terms of Scorsese movies, it's maybe not near the top of my list. But
yeah,
holy cow. Yeah.
Right. And I agree. It's probably like my three or four in Scorsese's catalog, but it won the Academy Award, which is what we're doing today, which, could kind of also be a bit of a foreshadowing as to what the Academy, what the hell are they doing every year, but what are you going to do, man? At least Scorsese got his gold with The Departed. So,
yeah,
that's my number two, man. And I'm excited, brother. We're up to our number ones. So you went classic with your runner up and with your number five. But really, you've kind of been all over the spectrum. So I'm excited to see what your number one best picture winner is. What do you got, man?
So my number one is one that, like Casablanca, has those those themes that are universal, you know, that it's also at its heart kind of a romance, but it's not simple. You know, it's really layered and complex. And the reason it ended up over Casablanca is, like I said, Casablanca is not a film that I personally can put myself in the shoes of these characters, you know, 100%. You know, I don't, the fighting, you know, in a war and, like, you know, being a revolutionary or whatever, like that kind of stuff, I don't really connect with. But both films are ultimately about how difficult it is to do what's right. Mm-hmm. And when trying to figure out which one of these was going to be number one, I went with the movie that ultimately I can relate to most and maybe find more inspiring as a writer, which is 1960's The Apartment by Billy Wilder.
I saw this one on a couple lists. I got to come clean. I've never seen this, man. So talk to me a little bit about this one, because this is one of maybe 20 or 25 movies that won the last 90 years that I haven't seen.
Yeah, it's a film about a guy who works in an office, you know, and it's a film that, I guess, by today's standards, you'd see movies, you'd watch it and you go, I've seen a million movies like this. It's a guy who works in an office and he gets lost in the mix or whatever, and he's got to make choices. But I mean, for its time, it's really savvy with its critique of corporate America, you know, and we're talking 1960 here. And it's a film about a guy, he's a bachelor, you know, he's just trying to get by, and his way of sort of gaining favor with his bosses, and he's played by Jack Lemmon, by the way, and is he gains favor with his superiors by letting them use his apartment to conduct their affairs. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, like, they meet up with women in his apartment, so he's got to keep it stocked with booze and stuff like that.
Okay.
But it becomes complicated when his personal affections for someone in the office then, you know, come into conflict with this situation. And the film is ultimately about him trying to weigh his humanity against personal financial success.
Gotcha. So is this would be considered a drama, or is this like a dramedy, or would it?
It's more of a dramedy. It starts out really light and funny, but it goes serious, deep places, you know, and it gets dark later on. But like at first, it's pure comedy, and it's Jack Lemmon just being brilliant. The script by Wilder and I.L. Diamond is, I don't know, one of the great scripts of all time. And it's just a film that, to me, I look at it today and I see these problems still around. You know, it resonates, you know, so many years later on a very modern level, whereas Casablanca is about, you know, the Nazis and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, we have The Apartment, which is about just being a working person struggling to get by and also still trying to be a human being, you know.
Awesome.
And it's a beautiful film. And I followed my heart to put this one at number one.
Oh, so did I. Yeah. I mean, you and several others, unless they know me personally, are going to be surprised by my number one, too. But, well, I mean, if nothing else, it's on my to-do list now. So, and I saw that pop up. I don't know if you know, but this is not a new thing we're doing here, Jeff. So,
yes,
there's a few lists out there on the internet of, you know, Oscar winners. And The Apartment was on several top five, top 10 lists. And it was one that I kept kind of repeated seeing, and I kept going, I wonder why I haven't seen this, because it wasn't like it was on one or two. It kept popping up. So obviously well received. I love Jack Lemmon. So yeah, it's one that I'm going to be checking out, man. So if nothing else, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's definitely not one of the most, like, bombastic, in-your-face kind of movies, you know? Casablanca's got Nazis, you know, and Silence of the Lambs has cannibals, you know, and other movies have war scenes.
Right,
and this
is
about a guy in an apartment, you know? And it's, so on that level, it's one that I think can easily get lost in the mix. It's just, you know, masterfully crafted for what it is, and yeah, again, my heart, that's where it had to go.
Well, me too, man. So I'll piggyback on what you said there and let everyone know that I'm going with my heart as well. This is my number two favorite movie of all time. And it happened to win the Academy Award for Best Picture, so I was able to put it on this list at number one. I have a personal connection to this movie that really has absolutely zero to do with the movie itself. So I'll talk about that first. But what I'm naming as my number one is Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven from 1992.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So my personal connection to this movie is my father passed away in 1995. And this is the last movie that he took me to see. We used to go see movies in the theater together, and he got really ill the last couple of years of his life. And this was the last movie we saw in the theater together, and he was a giant Clint Eastwood fan throughout my whole life. I mean, I watched all the old Westerns. All the Clint Eastwood films that you can name right now, I watched all of them in my home with my father. And when we heard Clint was doing a new movie and that it was a Western, which he'd actually taken a break from for several years in 92 when this came out, I don't know the exact time frame, but I want to say it had been at least 10 or 15 years since he had done a Western at that point. And my dad was just like a little boy. I mean, he was just so excited on Christmas morning, you know. And we, there were every once in a while, he would take me out to the theater. And this was one of the ones that he was like, we got to see it. We got shitty seats. We were in the front row on the far left. And me and him's necks are, you know, just up, staring up at the ceiling the whole time. But what a ride, man. I mean, have you seen Unforgiven, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's okay. It's brilliant.
It don't seem real. I ain't gonna never breathe again, ever. How he's dead. And the other one, too. All on account of pulling a trigger.
It's a hell of a thing, killing a man. You take away all he's got, and all he's ever gonna have.
Yeah. Well, I guess they had it coming.
Yeah, I love this movie, man. I mean, I'm not a fan of Westerns, which is what's ironic. You know, I shared that with my father, and I would watch those in my house. But, you know, I wasn't, like, seeking out Westerns when they came out. I just wasn't a big Western genre person. But, I mean, Gene Hackman as the villain in this movie, Morgan Freeman as the just his best friend, really, in the movie, his partner. And this is a story kind of mirroring what Clint Eastwood was kind of going through in his life, to be honest, is that he felt like a washed up has been a little bit, and just like maybe his best years were behind him. And, you know, Clint plays Will Money in the film, who is a notorious kind of Billy the Kid type outlaw in the Old West, who's grown old and is kind of over that life, but has to kind of be thrust back into it to get money for his children. And it's just an awesome story that plays out, and it ends up kind of being an awesome vengeance story as well. A great final act to this film. I mean, goosebumps every time I watch it. Clint Eastwood just kind of coming back to get revenge for his best friend, who's portrayed by Morgan Freeman. Richard Harris has a great role in this film. I want to say Eastwood won director for this as well, and Gene Hackman won supporting actor, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, just a tremendous movie, man. One of my favorite movies of all time. I have that connection with my father with it as well, which makes it even better. But yeah, this one, I mean, as soon as I knew this was Best Picture, we were doing this list, there nothing else could be my number one because of my connection to this movie.
Yeah.
Ever since I saw it, it has remained one of my favorite films of all time. In 2004, it got added to the National Film Registry, the Library of Congress, which is awesome. Of course, they do that for its cultural and historical impact. So yeah, which I'm sure several of yours are probably in there as well. But Unforgiven is my number one, brother. You're a fan of this one?
Yeah, it's a beautiful pick. I mean, I'm also not a big fan of Westerns, which is also weird because the most successful script I've ever written that actually ended up optioned was a Western. So that's weird.
You should stick to that, man. You should come up with what else you're not into and just start writing scripts about.
I know, right? But like there were a few films that really did inspire me in the writing of that. A lot of them were like esoteric existential Westerns from like the 60s and 70s, and then just the sort of brutality of Unforgiven, you know?
Right.
But I also love that you picked it for this very personal reason, because I think that something that, I don't know, gets people overlook when they start fighting online about like what the best movies are or whatever, is you can't underestimate how important who you saw a movie with and when you saw it is to your experience of that movie. And that's what's beautiful about cinema. You know, you can watch the right movie with the wrong person and it's the wrong movie, you know, like all of a sudden. And a movie like this really is elevated by those personal moments, you know, those touchstones in our lives.
Well, thanks, man. And I agree. I mean, you know, I always do Heart Overhead. I mean, every once in a while, I'll let my head creep in, like critical acclaim and, you know, the comments online and that kind of stuff. But if it's my favorite, it's my favorite. And, yeah. You know, usually it's because of a personal connection, to be honest. It's not because, like, oh, my God, it won so many awards and whatever, whatever. It's because I just connected to it the most. So I agree with you, man. Obviously, because American Beauty is on my list. So, I'm not too afraid, I guess. I'll tell people. Okay, so that was it, man. That's our top fives. You want to wrap up your five real quick? Remind everyone.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So my number five, if I remember correctly, is The Godfather. Oh,
yeah. Changed it, I know. Forgot.
Yeah. Shuffled it around. The Godfather at 5, 4, Silence of the Lambs, 3, No Country for Old Men, 2, Casablanca, and 1, The Apartment.
Awesome, man. The only one I haven't seen is The Apartment, but I will be checking it out, believe me. My top five was The Hurt Locker, American Beauty, Silence of the Lambs, The Departed, and Unforgiven from 1992 was my number one. You want to do some honorable mentions, man? I got five more that would have rounded out my top 10, but I'm not sure how many you have over there. Do you have any honorables you want to shout out?
I've got five, too.
Okay.
Obviously, Annie Hall got shuffled into the honorable mentions. Mm-hmm. Really important movie to me personally, but again, the Woody Allen thing, just heart and head were battling on this list, for
sure.
Yeah,
I agree.
So there's that Lawrence of Arabia from 1962. Okay. Hugely important in a couple of my relationships, like we were talking about there. Mm-hmm. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Jack Nicholson, 75. In the Heat of the Night from 67.
Mm, haven't seen that one. That's another one I haven't seen.
Oh, man. Obviously, Sidney Poitier. Warren Oates, who's one of my two favorite actors of all time.
Oh, awesome.
Is in there in a bit part. Beautiful performance. And then also Midnight Cowboy, 1969, the first X-rated movie to win Best Picture.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something there. By rounding out my top 10, by the way, we only had the one crossover Silence of the Lambs on our entire 10, our top 10. So my number six would have been Moonlight, which was last year's winner.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see Moonlight?
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Absolutely love that movie. My Fair Lady from 1964 is easily the oldest movie on my list. It is, I had to watch it in high school, which sounds weird, but I loved it when I watched it, and I still do. And whenever it's on TV, I have to watch a little piece of it and get a little taste of My Fair Lady there. So I love that one. That would have been my number seven. My number eight, you already mentioned, would have been No Country for Old Men. Number nine would have been Amadeus from 1984. And my number 10 would have been Gladiator from the year 2000 with Russell Crowe and Joaquin Phoenix. Another great villain story. Joaquin Phoenix is amazing as a villain in that movie. So that's our Best Picture winners, guys. And then, Jeff, if you're cool with it, man, I know you probably saw some of them, but I want to shout out a few people online as we open up the suggestion box.
Oh, cool, absolutely.
So let's see. Michael Hill, who's been on the show a couple times, a good friend of the show. He's got a couple that we didn't mention. Let's see what you think. He's got My Fair Lady, The Sound of Music. I don't know. I'm not big. What do you think? Sound of Music? What about musicals in general? You do musicals or no?
Yeah, I mean, like anything else. You know, if the movie's a good movie, I'm all for it. My Fair Lady, I'm a big fan of. We just showed it to Al recently.
Oh, awesome.
Sound of Music, I can't do Sound of Music. It's one of my wife's favorites, and I've seen it a couple times in its entirety.
That is an exact quote for me, because my wife loves this movie, and I'm just like, is it over yet? I just can't. And Amanda's going to hate me. We're going to mention her in a second. She's a dear, dear friend of the show, and she loves The Sound of Music.
I do.
Yeah. My wife loves it, so there's that. Michael's also got Silence of the Lambs, Gladiator, and then a couple we didn't mention yet, The King's Speech and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. How do you feel about the Lord of the Rings films?
I mean, I feel that's another one of those wins that's definitely political with the...
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was like that one won for the entire trilogy. You know? I mean, especially because I think Fellowship's the best of the series. That's my personal take on it. But... Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Well, truth be told, I've never been a big Lord of the Rings guy, so I've seen them, but I'm not like a super fan like a lot of people are. So,
dude, I saw Fellowship in the theater like 5 times.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's okay. Hey, that's cool, man. I don't know. It's just for me. I can't. It's hard for me to get to like go into a movie knowing it's going to be like 4 hours and be like, okay, this is going to be awesome. Yeah. It's going to be 4 hours. Yeah. So
that's
I kind
of
go in narrow-minded.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. That's why some of my stuff was in honorable mention rather than in my list, because it's like Lawrence of Arabia is brilliant, but like, do I really have 3 hours and 20 minutes or whatever to commit to a movie? Not usually.
Right. So, right. I just found out Endgame is going to be 3 hours and I'm like, oh God, really?
Oh boy.
Yeah, here we go. We'll figure it out, though. All right, and then we just mentioned Amanda, so I love her. She's from Picture Show A Go-Go, and she also does the Mafia Minute, so not surprising, but her number one is The Godfather. And then rounding out her top five would have been The Sound of Music, Rebecca, Casablanca, and The Godfather Part Two. What about Rebecca? Have you seen that one?
That's one of the ones that, and it's like on my list of, you know, ones that I've seen, that was the one that I remember kind of the least. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to rewatch it, but I couldn't find it to like stream anywhere. And apparently it's not in my Hitchcock box set. So I was just lost, but I remember loving it when I saw it in film school. We watched it for cinematography and studied like what kind of, this is the kind of lens that they used and they shot on this film stock or whatever. So like I studied the movie, but it's really faded in my memory for some reason.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Interesting. That's not in the box set being that it's an Oscar winner.
Yeah, it's like five movies in there.
Yeah, yeah. Tony Dobbish from Take Two, good friend of the show. His top five was Godfather 2, Schindler's List, Lawrence of Arabia, Silence of the Lambs, and there you go, Casablanca was his number five. Schindler's List we didn't talk about yet. That's this came up when I talked to our friend Paul, our mutual friend Paul. What do you think? I mean, is this Spielberg's best direction or is it Private Ryan?
Oh, I would say Schindler's List over Private Ryan. But I also probably will never watch Schindler's List again. It's one of those movies that I think is a work of art that's beautiful and should be seen. But like movies about the Holocaust and slavery and stuff like that, I watch them once, maybe twice. And I'm like, yeah, I know, man, the Holocaust was terrible. I don't like to put that in my head. It's like, you know, I've seen, you know, in your personal life, bad stuff happens. And so I try to veer a little more towards bittersweet rather than like downright depressing in my movie watching.
I told Paul the same thing when we had our Spielberg countdown, because I saw that movie when it came out and I haven't seen it since. It was just such a hard watch, man. I mean, it was so emotionally draining. But I mean, obviously one of the best ever and one of Spielberg's best for sure. Let's see. Paul, we're just talking about Paul. Here he is. Paul. So he said he can't give a list because he made a list for his show this week.
Yeah.
But he did want me to mention that Wayne would not let him have either of the Godfathers on his list. And I guess Wayne won that argument, which is weird to me.
What?
How did he let Wayne win?
Wayne, man.
I mean, there's no the times. Are there any boobs in the Godfather movies? That's probably why Wayne didn't pick it. I don't know.
I mean, there's a severed horse head. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, yeah, that's
in my book, that's a win.
So here we go, man. Now, Nick never disappoints. We are recording our top five Quentin Tarantino characters later. Here's his top five. I'm going to start at number five so I can work my way up to one here, because I applaud him for doing this. So his five was Amadeus. His four was Braveheart. Number three was Schindler's List. Number two was The Godfather. And number one for Nick was American Beauty.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Nick over from the Epic Film Guys. I love that dude. I love him and Justin. And I think that he is unapologetically like, I like what I like, F everyone else. Like, that's literally a quote from him. And I respect that. And, you know, he definitely is finding it easy to separate the art from the scandal. So I respect the fact that he decided to, because American Beauty is amazing, like we already talked about.
Yeah. And I used to find that really easy before I started teaching film, you know, having those conversations with people who are like, why are we watching this movie if this person did that and they made this movie? That, I mean, that really does change the whole landscape of your view of those films.
Right.
So,
I mean, look at the Cosby Show. I mean, I freaking love the Cosby Show, man. Yeah. I love watching reruns of it now, but it's just like, I mean, you just can't look at it the same way, no matter, you know, what you think. So
really going to learn family values from this guy,
I know. It's tough, man. It's disappointing. And then the last one I'll mention, good friend of the show, Wesley, who's actually local here in North Carolina. He said Braveheart is his best picture. That would be his number one, Braveheart. We didn't mention Braveheart, though, which I find interesting.
We didn't talk about that.
Yeah, that's an epic one, man. I'm not like a giant fan of Braveheart. I mean, I like it and I respect it. What about you?
Yeah.
You put that one up there as well, or
I like it and respect it. I used to teach with it when I taught ethics. I used mm-hmm. that because it was a really interesting case study and, you know, the minor historical changes that they did for that. Mm-hmm. Like, who cares? You know, like maybe right. they didn't wear blue face paint, but it's badass. So. Yeah. Whatever.
And of course, I mean, of course you take artistic liberties in Hollywood. I mean, that's nothing new. So I like Braveheart. It's not one of my favorites, but I do like it. Well, anyway, I enjoyed recording this with you, Jeff. Why don't you tell all the folks where they can find you? I appreciate you being here, man. Why don't you tell everyone where they can find you and Al over there?
Yeah, sure. So you can find CadaverCast, I don't know, anywhere you listen to podcasts, iTunes, SoundCloud, I don't know, Stitcher, that kind of stuff. And we are on Twitter at Cadaver_cast.
Yep. I follow you and I love you, and it's a great show, man. Give my best to Al, and you guys keep doing what you do over there. Hopefully you'll be back on soon, man. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, Al was upset that when I told him this morning that we were going to record, he was like, oh, you're recording with Gerald of Two Peas on a Pod? He's like, can I do a list for it? And I was like, I don't think so.
Do I have to start watching my language? Is he going to be listening every week? I got to start watching my language.
I mean... He hears the language. We live in Chicago, man. You know, walking down the street, the stuff you hear.
He's heard it all, right? He's heard it all.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, my partner Andy's a minister, so you know he usually balances me out because he doesn't say very many cuss words. So I'll try to be more mindful for Al, though. Tell him I really appreciate it. And for Jeff, this is Gerald signing off for this episode of Two Peas. We'll see you guys next time. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, man. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
You've been listening to a Blazing Caribou Studios production. Support and subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/blazingcariboustudios.